Welcome to the Annotated Jack. Non-productive's late to the party rewatch of Samurai Jack. It's been 15 years since Genndy Tartakovsky's groundbreaking animated series first went on the air, and in preparation for its upcoming fifth season, we're rewatching every episode of the original show.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm James, and I'm joined not at all in studio by
Frank.
Oh!
Why did we yell it?
Wow. Yeah. Don't need to yell at me. I feel like I didn't do anything wrong, you know, in this specific instance. Today, we are actually going to be talking about episode 5, Jack and the Warrior Woman. This is one of my favorite episodes from season 1.
Really?
I'm about to say the exact same thing. Frank, like, really? Like, I mean, it's fine, but I don't know if I'd call it my favorite.
I really like this episode. Maybe it's just because, like, I didn't find it so obvious when I was a kid, the twist in the episode, but all the fun nods that they do to try to tell you what's actually happening, I find really enjoyable, particularly early on. You know, once you get about halfway through, they get a little, a little obvious. But right at the beginning, the foreshadowing's really cool. And I love good use of foreshadowing. So this is a fun episode. Plus, we haven't had an opportunity to this point yet, really, to have Jack as a character kind of play off another character. You know what I mean? Like, if you see the relationship with the Woolies or with, the dogs or things like that, there really isn't that kind of, like, almost, a chemistry kind of going on there. And yes, for some reason, there is here, and that I find fun.
It's so far, Jack's journey has been a very lonely one. And we kind of were hungering to see him interact with another person as an equal, making friends, as it were, making allies and moving his way through this world, which just makes this thing just a pantsing all the way through. Just completely. Speaking of pantsing and fun things that you did not notice when you were a kid, what did you think of the blatant racism we started the episode off with?
A little bit. I did find that concerning. That was also a thought that went through my mind at the beginning. I was like, oh, this is a lot more problematic than I remember.
Right. From the, like, quasi-Arabic yodeling to the style of dress of all these characters, it's just kind of ridiculous. And it made me think back to the first episode, which took place in the past, and how much I felt that they kind of honored. And it's sort of a spin on its head. There's something about this episode that makes me feel kind of wonky. But when you saw the ancient world, which of course all took place in during different periods of the ancient world, it kind of like felt right. I think it's this thing that we all did as kids, which was try to put fictional races as a skin on top of real world races. What I mean is, when you're playing a game of D&D and your dwarves all have Scottish accents, you know?
Right.
Like that.
Yeah.
It's, and you know, it's not always a problem, but oftentimes you look back and you're like, I don't know why all these monsters
dwarves are Scottish.
why all the monsters and all the characters in this part of the world are ridiculous stereotypes. It's hard. It's a hard thing to deal with, especially when you're dealing with sword and sorcery, which traditionally has just milked those stereotypes to death.
So yeah, it definitely creates a very awkward, and it didn't open that well either. Like, that was my big thing. Like, I didn't mind so much the aesthetics. Like, once they got down to him walking around, and like there was the guy with the scorpions on his face, I thought that was really cool. There were some elements to it I thought were interesting. It was this weird, because I like the idea that aliens kind of came, took over parts of Earth, and then kind of became caricatures of Earth culture, if that makes any sense.
Which was what, like, we have to assume happened. Maybe there are planets out there that are, like, you know, Earth culture world. Each world has its own climate and own culture that's just like ours, but alien. I don't know.
I mean, I didn't think that was the alien culture. I thought that was just them living in our world and sort of weirdly adapting it.
That, like, is a ridiculous concept.
I mean,
concept.
I'm not trying to make excuses for it because it felt weird, but I guess maybe what they were trying to go for was that, like, oh, well, they came here and they, like, took away something from us. And, like, I mean, you could make the argument, although I don't think it's true, that, like, well, they don't know what the culture really is. They're just, kind of doing a weird caricature of it.
No, I don't think so.
Necessarily want to give the writers that much credit.
I don't even think it's about credit. I really do think, like, if you look back at the source material and what they're trying to mimic, the style they're trying to mimic, you could always look back at Sword and Sorcery. You know, you look back at, like, Conan and early kind of pulp stories, and in those stories they would milk real world cultures or like stereotypes of real world cultures to kind of build up the world that they're in. So I just think it's part of the shorthand conventions of the genre is to be all right, we're setting in the Middle East at this time, so it's going to be like long, like so like in long journeys through the desert and, you know, oases and you know, bazaars, that's all going to be part of it. Even the shopkeeper is like a trope character from that world. It kind of works. It's kind of weird, too. It's funny. But you know what? I accept all of it just for the bubble hookah. If I can have a bubble hookah, like a hookah that just blows bubbles, that is the step above and the natural successor to the bubble pipe. In fact, it makes more sense. Bubble hookah. That's what I want for my birthday.
I was about to say, I think I know what I'm getting Frank for Christmas.
Nice.
There you go.
Bubble hookah.
I did enjoy how this story did tie in with the Woolies plot because, I mean, the Woolies literally gave him the directions and the passcode to speak with the shopkeeper.
Right. Like, you can tell, even though Samurai Jack's very episodic, they're trying to connect his journey in ways that make it enjoyable for viewers who are tuning in each week.
So aside from the gag with the shopkeeper who's trying to sell him a rug, he's also there for a lesson, directions to find something his inner heart is looking for as provided by the vision that the light of eternity provides him. A way home that only somebody pure of heart can access. So this is the setup for an eventual twist in this episode that young James never saw coming.
I don't know if I never saw it coming, but I enjoyed their uses of foreshadowing, right? So the shaman, when the fight begins, you know, he references the ultimate evil, and Jack, you know, obviously thinks that it's, you know, it's the warriors he's about to fight or, you know, Aku off in the distance. And the shaman says, you don't understand. And
he's
then the battle breaks out.
He's definitely a shopkeeper, you definitely racist bastard.
Oh, come on. He's like magic, right? With DeBron, he has the thing.
So we're going to do an episode one thing about that guy with the butterfly wings and... so embarrassing. But yeah, you're right. I think that there's even a cut or a beat right on the evil, and it cuts to Akira showing up, but
yep.
Obviously the misdirect, it's the robot assassins.
Yep. Well, and how the robot assassins stop chase, they make a point to show that the robot assassins stop chasing Jack and Akira after they've escaped.
Down to giving them little smiles in their eyes. They don't have mouths, but their eyes definitely have the anime smile on them.
There's the mouse when Akira and Jack are eating at their campfire in the desert. The mouse is very happy to accept food from Jack, but runs away from Akira.
That's true. Actually, you know, that gag, I think that's like a masterclass in gag right there. So you've got the little mouse, it's scared of Akira, and it's, well, it likes Jack and is scared of Akira, and you could say that that's foreshadowing, and clearly it is, but it would be too obvious if they just had that, so it turns it into a joke. If you remember, it's an excuse for Jack to, laugh at Akira, like, oh, you're so silly, you can't, or not even you're so silly, you're just... you failed at luring in a mouse. That's funny. I'm going to laugh at that. And they have a shared moment of, we rib each other. It's okay. But in reality, he's just closing his eyes to an obvious clue. It's a really good staged gag.
There are other things that I think aren't necessarily as obvious clues. They try to keep a height difference going between the two of them. Not to say that, you know, not everybody can be tall. You know, obviously there can be characters taller than Jack, but... Mm. You know, Aku is significantly taller, and I think Akira has a head, you know, at least on Jack. There's the scene kind of with the belly dancer. If you think back at that scene, Akira doesn't seem interested in the male belly dancer, only in the female belly dancer, which, again, doesn't necessarily say, you know, this has to be a coup in disguise, but it could also be foreshadowing.
And it also kind of, like, I mean, it goes to the idea, like, obviously they're trying to go with this faux Jack romance plot where Jack is kind of opening up to this other person. And
oh, they're trying to start a ship. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
and yeah, yeah. Obviously, Aku is trying to encourage that, so the betrayal is that much worse at the end.
I wonder if, I mean, it's a little early. This was 2001, but I wonder if at any point, was there a Aku Samurai Jack ship based on this episode? Huh. If you know, leave a comment on this podcast and get it taken down from the iTunes store or whatever. I don't know how it works.
There you go.
That's interesting. The turban. I actually, just for that one scene with the belly dancer, I love the turban fake out. Did you see that in the beginning where when he first runs into this tribe, the guy who they look like they're being, you know, surrounded by soldiers, and the one the head of that little tribe or that caravan or wherever they were, like, he sticks his hands out in greeting, which is a callback to the first episode when that guy, I don't know, it definitely felt like a callback to me for
I see what you're talking about.
I think it's interesting. There's also the our Lord and Master Aku, which is how Akira refers to Aku and her place in the world. It sounds like a little, you know, that's a little too reverential. You know the word I'm using.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's certainly a very interesting dynamic. Like, I didn't have the same thing that James did when I watched this the first time. Like, I kind of bet it. That this woman was going to turn out to be evil. Like, I kind of called that, like, you know, moment one.
Mm-hmm.
But it being a coup, oddly enough, was the thing that was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, that kind of actually threw me a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have automatically guessed it was him.
But it's so cool because they use the exact same color scheme, right? So all of Aku's colors are in Akira's colors, right? Even if they change it around a little bit, like the white and the red are subtle and stuff like that.
Right.
But,
and I'll tell you, there's a couple of subtle things you could do. So when your audience is genre savvy, you have to be really good at subverting their expectations. So I'm pretty genre savvy. So I think the first time I saw it, my expectation was she was going to be evil, but she was going to be Aku's daughter because of the color scheme and all the suggestions and hints that she was somehow linked to Aku. But because, again, the conventions in the genre is the male lead will be seduced by or, you know, have these feelings for a vixen or what's the actual tool? A femme fatale, I think, is what the term is usually, who is somehow related to usually the daughter of the big villain that's in the story. That's like Ming the Merciless and Princess Aurora, I think. I can't remember her name. But, like, you know,
I know what you're referencing.
You know, it's a trope. It's a pretty standard thing. So that's what I was expecting. To find out it was actually a coup is really disturbing in a way that you could pretty much get away with on a kid's cartoon because, you know, otherwise it's odd. It's just unexpected. Yeah. But
I think it makes it all the more, like, really hurtful to Jack because it's like it's the first time he's kind of opened up since he's been here. And it's to the ultimate evil. It's not even to someone who works for him. It's not even like, it's like, I was vulnerable and open to, like, to the person I'm trying to murder.
Yeah.
So, like, all, like, it's not even,
we've
like,
all been there. Well, I guess I'm the only one who's been there.
I've been there.
I think you're the only one who's been there, Frank.
But it's really like, it was really interesting. And I really liked the frustration that he went through and it. I enjoyed it. But again, as much as I enjoy that, the episode itself doesn't. It's neither a slow build nor is it a compelling build to that final scene that makes the episode worth it. I mean, it's very weird because I know you only have like a very small amount of time to tell that story. But again, despite it not being who I thought it was, I still kind of pegged they were evil. And the desert adventure is
it wasn't
wild,
enough for you. Yeah,
kind of interesting. it doesn't have a lot of beats besides that we're running, hit something, run.
Oh, I'll disagree with you. I'll definitely disagree with you on that. I think it's got a great beat. In fact,
yeah.
And that is the music. The music in this episode was on point.
Yeah, okay, good point, good point.
James
good point.
L. Venable, who did the music in this episode, and I think a few others in the series, if not all of them, really just got this great old world and techno vibe going. It is definitely traveling music if you ever want to drive across a long distance where there's no traffic. I highly recommend.
And it's fantastic.
I think it's somewhat tragic. I mean, this is one of those situations where Jack gets two no's in a row, right? He loses another way to get home, but I think more importantly is he loses his first chance at an ally. And that is probably the more crushing. Well, speaking of not having enough time to go into the story, I think we're wrapping up this episode.
I think we are. We are wrapping up talking about episode 6, because I was totally wrong and I can't read Roman numerals, Jack and the Warrior Woman.
Oh, so you were wrong in the beginning when you said, what was it, 5?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, God, James. So sorry.
I told you, come on, this is one of my favorite episodes, despite the problematic things that I didn't recognize as a kid. It's just cool. It's just a good episode. I love a good bit of foreshadowing. It's got great music. It's good, Jack.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah, do you know what episode we're doing next?
Next, we will be talking about, I think it's The Three Blind Archers?
Yes.
Yep. Jack and the Three Blind Archers.
That's a good episode, in my opinion. Very cool.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.